Hello and welcome to Rewatchability, part of the Entertainment One podcast network. I'm Jay McNabb, joined by a very special guest today. It's a guest who's been on the show before. It's our friend Sina Ramani. Hey, Sina.
Hello. And lovely to be back.
Oh, well, thanks for coming. It's just going to be the two of us today. We're going to do something a little bit different. And I do want to thank all of our Patreon donors and say that we're sorry that it's been another bit of a gap between the last time we did an episode. We've all been beset by illnesses and work, and Blaine was beset by a baby.
What? I didn't know that.
You didn't?
No. How did I miss that?
I guess you don't listen to the show. Because
I listened to the Uncle Buck episode.
We were in the delivery room podcasting live. No, but we did mention it.
That you did mention. I must have missed that.
Yeah, Blaine.
Congratulations.
Yeah,
Blaine.
Well, he's not.
That's exciting.
He's not going to hear this. But we had. At least I had a rough couple of weeks. I had a cold and like weeks of stomach food poisoning thing. No one wants to hear about that because it's Christmas and. That's not what Christmas is about. Or maybe it is. I don't know. We wanted to do a few episodes before the year wrapped up to actually deliver some episodes before the holiday season is over. So hopefully everybody will be back next week to do something a bit more conventional. But Sina and I had an idea that we concocted that is a little bit different. It deviates a little bit from our usual template of rewatchability. And I'm excited about it because what we're going to do is we're going to talk a bit more broadly about probably one of the most adapted stories of all time, not just Christmas stories, but of any story. And that is Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And we have talked in the past about a few adaptations specifically, like we did Scrooged on the show. We talked about the Muppet Christmas Carol, obviously, but Sina, you are a recovering academic.
Yes. And even then, I'm a recovering Disney. I'm a recovering Dickens.
Disney
expert.
Disney bought Charles Dickens. His name is Charles Disney now. That's how you have to refer to him.
Why did I say Disney? Yeah, I wrote a dissertation on Charles Dickens plays a pretty big role in at least my PhD dissertation. I wrote a chapter. It's about orphanhood. The entire project is called Blank Subjects, and it's about the rise of what I call a kind of I kind of make the case for looking through the thematic of what I call orphanhood and not look at individual orphans. So even though a lot of people notice the fact that, you know, there's a whole huge history of orphans, especially in like kind of 19th century and 18th century British literature, that the kind of conversation got stuck at this idea of the orphan, you know, kind of people using this thing, like, which is kind of like out of date, right? Like nobody talks about archetypes. Archetypal criticism like went out the window. So I kind of said talk about orphanhood, and, you know, you can't talk about orphanhood in the British novel without talking about Charles Dickens.
That guy loves orphans.
He loves orphans. And I made a case against Oliver Twist, and I made a case for Great Expectations as like a far more profound and interesting and powerful sort of narrative of orphanhood, whereas the goal of Oliver Twist is kind of to correct this kid and reconnect him to his parents and his lineage. You know, the story of Great Expectations is really interesting, and it's about adopting people and like doing and like making connections outside of your family and going off into the world. And so I kind of, you know, I was kind of interesting. And just to bring it back to this conversation, you know, rereading Christmas Carol, I always was like kind of racist against Christmas Carol. Like I was like, oh, whatever, because, you know, when you're a scholar,
wait, how like, can you be racist to
like you have to you when you like focus on an author so deeply and you spend a lot of time reading it, you end up kind of going towards a certain kind of figure of that author. So in the case of Dickens, a lot of people like sort of go towards late Dickens, right? Like the stuff that's like really heavy, the thick stuff. Like Great Expectations is like, you know, one of my favorites. And, you know, so that period of his life, and whereas this is like a different period, this is kind of like this is kind of mid period. I guess it doesn't really matter about periodizations, but it more to the fact that I definitely sort of shied away from this book, and rereading it now, and I reread it, and I also listened to a version of it, which we should talk about, because I think that's like a huge thing with Dickens, is like the prose is like audible.
Yeah, yeah.
But this book actually reminds me a lot of Great Expectations, and the great things about Great Expectations. So this was a real treat for me to sort of dive back into this, and I also watched a bunch of movies and adaptations.
Yeah,
some I had seen before, but anyways, that's my intro.
Yeah, you have a real Dickens background. You've read a lot of Dickens. You can speak very thoughtfully about that. And I've seen a lot of like mid-90s network television, of which A Christmas Carol played a big part. So I think we'll meet in the middle and be able to talk about this.
It's commercial content. Chickens was a content factory. That's what they share in common.
Right. Well, we're not going to do like a rundown. Everybody knows the story of A Christmas Carol. It's this timeless classic that, if you're not familiar with it, you are a robot sent here from another planet. So let's just talk about the book first before we get into some of the movie versions and TV versions that we're familiar with. The book, I've read the book, but I read it a few years ago. I didn't reread it for this podcast. I'm not as committed as you, even though you're a guest.
But so, I know, I prepared more for this than any of my shows.
Well, it is a really short book. I listened to an audiobook version, or most of one as well, which we'll talk about. But tell me about like what hit you about reading it now that you didn't see necessarily in the past.
I'll tell you exactly what it is. Part of the kind of broader story of Charles Dickens' life and his work is that he became a kind of prisoner, and I'm kind of stealing this from a recent book by, is it Norton? Anne Norton?
Yes, of course.
I was just like checking it out the other day, and he kind of became like a prisoner, and it's a great way of sort of summarizing it. He became a prisoner of his own books, like a kind of character, because he lived this complicated life. Anyways, let's cut to the chase of this story, that this book is an important kind of launching point of a kind of a mode of writing that Dickens would return to again and again in the decades after, which is kind of memory and thinking about memory and using using memory as a place to manufacture, like the act of recollecting as a way of writing a story. So what do I mean by that is that, you know, the main sort of thrust of this novel is jumping through time, is these various kind of supernatural figures, these three ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
They jump through time and they access this guy's life, right? And they access the sort of the character of Ebenezer Scrooge, who's this kind of miserly bureaucrat figure. Yeah,
just a real jerk.
The prototypical, like prototypical miser, prototypical bad boss. And, you know, kind of in the modern
horrible
sense,
bosses.
Yeah, in the modern sense of bosses and employers, like industrial England. So part of, and again, sorry to just keep doing this, but to understand the sort of era that Dickens is writing in, like I don't mean to be dramatic, but like this is like an apocalyptic time in the era that he lives in. Like smokestacks are billowing like clouds of death.
Right.
There is like the industrial violence of this era cannot be overstated. Like in the previous century, in like the previous like 75 years, like a certain class of people, the rise of a certain class of people in England, but this sort of replicated itself across the UK, and they kind of managed to, well, the UK didn't exist then, but anyways, the sort of broader history is that they managed to sort of rip out a whole way of being in the country. And because of the Industrial Revolution, labor was needed in the cities. And the cities that we know, the modern European cities, are really kind of come together in vast ways in the 19th century, right? And Dickens lives this time. He lives the kind of ground zero of this massive, like, apocalyptic, really, just like rivers are being flooded. There's this thing called the Great Stink, okay? Like, go look that up, where, like there's so much shit washing up into the Thames and stuff, into like the shores of it, that it's like causes the whole city to smell like shit for 2 months,
right,
in like a summer. Like this is like untrammeled, or like what's the word I'm looking for? Like unhindered capitalism, let loose upon what was essentially like an agrarian society, right? So like,
thank God we got that all sewn up.
Right, exactly. So like, you know, the air quality things now, you can't even imagine. And like work was brutal and hard, and there was no kind of labor struggles. Like, it's no accident that kind of Marx lives in London around the same time that Dickens does, towards the ends at least. But and Marx kind of lived that life of 19th century Europe that like you think of, like living in this dungeon, whatever. Anyways, lots of kids, like infant mortality, all these things. So to sort of just situate this story in kind of Dickens's career is to think about a kind of successful man, and this book brings him to new levels of success. But he had already established at this point, even though it's like, you know, he's a pretty big name, but like, he's now kind of established enough and looking backwards in his life. And this book is, and the narrative's kind of arc is, these characters bring this guy who lives in the present day and only for the present day, and they force him to look back at his life, look around his life in the contemporary, and look into the future. And what he sees is so traumatizing that it forces him to like reconsider himself and reconsider his life. And really the one sort of narrative trick that I think of, that I never noticed before, is that they use this thing of like, when the Christmas passed, is that he uses a cone on top of his head, like the sort of how they explain it, because it is a realist novel in the way, even though it breaks the rules of that, it's like it falls into this kind of fable, but it's still kind of realism. And the way that, which is why it starts with like, you know, Jacob Marley was dead. The Marleys was dead was Muppet Christmas Carol. Yeah.
I love that it's Jacob and Robert. Marley.
Yes. Bob Marley. Yeah. But like, so like that thing, that narrative technique of like, oh, he puts it on like the
Ghost of Christmas Past.
Ghost of Christmas Past kind of puts this thing on his head, and it sort of emanates all these memories, right? And like, that was really powerful to me, because essentially what this is that a guy walking through the novel of his own life.
Yeah.
The novelization, that somehow someone was writing all of this down, and now I'm walking through it, and now I'm forced to learn about the mistakes that I've made. So
I was
that
gonna
for
ask
me
you,
was really powerful.
I didn't reread this, but like, I did want to talk about like the way the ghosts are described, and the way, because I think, especially like the Ghost of Christmas Past doesn't really have in its cinematic adaptations like a common visual, you know, descriptor, or like any, like each one seems to just, like, some are just a dude, some are like a little floating angel, some, you know, like they vary wildly. Whereas, you know, the present and the future seem to have like, you know, one's like a big dude in a robe, the other's, you know, like the Grim Reaper.
And a green robe, yeah.
Yeah, so like there are sort of like, there's a template for that, but the Ghost of Christmas Past always seems to be like a bit of a surprise. So what, do you remember what it says in the book for?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
It's a dude with a cone?
Okay, here we go. Even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. Here it is. But the strangest thing about it was, from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light, by which all of this was visible, and which was doubtless the occasion of its using, in its duller moments, a great extinguisher for a cap, which it now held under its arm. Even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. For as its belt sparkled and glittered now in one part and now in another, and what was light one instant and another time and another at another time was dark, so the figure itself fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, now a head without a body, of which dissolving parts, no outline would be visible in the dense gloom wherein they melted away. And in the very wonder of this, it would be itself again, distinct and clever as ever. Yeah, this is good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can see reading that and being like, oh, let's just get Buster Poindexter in a taxi cab.
I mean, it's like, yeah, no, it's this, it really is this vision. I mean, the whole thing of Jacob Marley also confronting him is like him, the ghostliness of him. And so at one point, this, like, his jaw drops, right? And that the best adaptation of that. I mean, I know we're not getting into that, but we should. But that's 100% Scrooged, the Bill Murray thing, with like the best. Like, I mean, the fun thing about this book and the many adaptations of it is that you can, and this is true with Dickens in general, is that you can watch all these different people from different backgrounds and different contexts with different media limitations. Like, there's radio adaptations, a ton of them right? So, like, with different limitations and different forms, take on this, you know, pretty straightforward story, right? Like, there's nothing really special about it. Like, but it as we just read, each character has these kind of supernatural elements, even though it is a realist novel, right? Like, it's not a fantasy novel. It's not Harry Potter, right? Where, like, these are magical things that live in this world, where it's just like, this guy lives in a real bleak world of mid-19th century London.
Yeah.
Like, it's brutal. It's cold. He's eating gruel. You know, he's this lonely, miserly dude. He's just kind of mean, a jerk. Nobody likes him. No family, nothing. Like an orphan, right?
Well, this guy who's kind of orphanhood. Because obviously your focus, your background in terms of examining Dickens was in terms of orphanhood. What is the Scrooge background? Is he an orphan? I know he's kind of like sent away from his family, like boarding school or whatever, but do his parents die?
So, okay. Like, I mean, even though I reread it, this is actually a hard question for me to read. There is, when they jump into his past, because now all I think of is Bill Murray and like him being watching TV as a kid, right? Like watching a Western. That's all I see. But like when they jump into his past, there's a kind of he visits his friends and what was his name? Wizzywig? Fozziwig? Whatever his name was. Fozziwig might have been something too. Yeah.
Fozziwig is definitely. I'll give you a clue for figuring it out. If the name contains the name of a Muppet, it's probably from the Muppet one.
Bob Marley, that's still so good.
Not to jump too far ahead, because we're going to talk about the movie versions in a second, but in like the Alistair Sim movie, I was reading that one of the additions to that was the idea that Scrooge's nephew, who he's such an asshole to, was, I don't know if he was explicitly an orphan, but the idea was that his mother died in childbirth, and who is Scrooge's sister, who he loved, and that's why he's so mean to him. And I love the fact that movie was just like punching up Dickens, whereas like, and totally successfully, but like, you know, they were like looking at the story and being like, well, I think we need a reason why he's just such a jerk to this poor guy.
A few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth.
Why?
Because it is at Christmas time that want is most keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What can I put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous.
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, sir, that is my answer. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. Those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there.
And some would rather die.
If they would rather die, they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, it's not my business.
Isn't it, sir?
No.